And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Michael P. from San Diego.
You know, before we start, would you mind just give me a moment of silence? And I'd like to do a really short prayer, if you don't mind. God, help me to be a clear, transparent channel of your life, your love, your wisdom, and your power. May we do your will always. Amen. Thank you. My name is Michael, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 6, 1990. My home group is Knucklehead Men's at USD on Wednesday night, and my sponsor's name is Joe C. And I was told that if I could maintain those three things, it'd be possible to never take a drink again. My sponsor has a sponsor, and I've also been able to sponsor several men that I meet on a weekly basis for at least an hour apiece, and that's helped me stay sober. I really want to talk about the gifts of the program and my sobriety tonight, especially the steps. But first, I need to qualify, you know, and let you know. I grew up as the oldest of five kids. My parents stayed together. I never really had what I call a troubled childhood. I grew up in St. Louis. I got sent to private schools. But you know what? I never felt like I fit in. And I was really chubby when I grew up. I was usually one of those guys that was the last picked. You know, when they chose up teams, it's like, okay, we'll take that guy, but we get two good guys in exchange. And, you know, I threw like a girl. I never did a lot of athletics. I stood in my room, read a lot of books, and I didn't fit in. And even though I was a pretty smart guy, when I found alcohol, when I was 16 or 17 years old, it did something for me that nothing else had done. It made me feel like I fit in finally. And that buzz at the back of your head, you know, all of a sudden, everything changed. And I did that as often as I could, even though it made me sick a lot in the very beginning. I moved out of the house pretty early to make room for the other kids, and went to college, didn't finish, went to another college, skipped out of there too, just went to work. And I got married at a pretty early age. I was 22. And if you drink like I drank, it's good to have somebody to manage your life, because I wasn't doing a very good job. And did a series of geographics, as we often do. After 8 years, that marriage wasn't working out. We argued a lot about my drinking for some reason. And so I fired her and found a new one. And in between there, I did get my DUI, which was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. I don't recommend drinking and driving the day before Thanksgiving, because, you know, that is the kickoff of the season, and the cops are out in force and they will get you. And they got me. But she came and bailed me out of jail, and I thought that was true love. And so I married her, and I got to keep drinking for another 7 years until that marriage crashed and burned also. And I have to say that in between there, because I knew that my drinking was a problem, because we had argued about it, to try to save that marriage, I stopped drinking, wrote a solemn vow like the book talks about. And I didn't go to AA. I didn't really know what an alcoholic was. I just knew I didn't want to get divorced again. And for 3.5 years, I didn't drink. I won't say I didn't do anything, but I didn't drink. And my life did slowly get better. I got a better job, got a promotion. By this time, I lived in Florida. I was in St. Petersburg. And then one day, when she was out of town, it had been 3.5 years, I thought, well, what the heck's going to happen if I have a beer? And really, the worst possible thing happened to me. I had one beer, and I waited, and nothing happened. And so I was convinced I was cured. So the next night, I got, you know, two, because if you're going to have one, you might as well have two. And after about a week of that, I realized I was wasting money and I might as well get a six pack and just have two. But then she fell asleep. So I drank a couple more, and now I didn't have enough. So I had to go back. And, you know, I thought it was a math problem, and it wasn't. It was a drinking problem, because really two beers didn't do anything for me. And what I can tell you is that after a week, I was right back to where I was before, pounding down about a half a bottle of vodka a day. And in Florida, I have to tell you, it's hotter than it is in San Diego. So that bottle of vodka out in the trunk, it gets pretty warm. It doesn't taste too good. But at least it makes it easier to know how much you got and that you always have enough, you know. And so if any of you have, you know, chugged some hot vodka, you know what that's all about. Mm-hmm. And it did what I wanted it to do. It gave me the effect that I needed to have. And that was in 1989 in February. By November, I was out of the house. And the way that happened, I have to give full credit to the program of Al-Anon. Because my wife started going to Al-Anon and she started taking my two stepsons to Al-Teen. And I said one night, I don't remember giving my permission for that. And she said, well, I don't remember asking your permission. And I said, if that's how it's going to be, maybe I should move out. And she said, maybe you should. And I didn't expect that. You know, she called my bluff. And what I can tell you is that I tried being sweet. I tried being angry. I tried everything I could to get control of her because I didn't have control of my drinking. And none of it worked. You know, none of it worked. The women of Al-Anon had clipped those wires. So the buttons I pushed didn't do a darn thing. And so I had no choice but to move out. And there I was, you know, 37 years old in an apartment that I really couldn't afford, overlooking a pool, you know, that I was hoping to meet somebody at. And the truth was that I really couldn't even turn off all the lights in my own apartment because I was scared of the dark. And really, you know, when we talk about the incomprehensible demoralization, I was able to control my drinking. Sometimes eventually it would get out of control. But what I really couldn't do anything about was the way I felt. I felt empty and hollow. I had failed twice in my marriage. And when I was living in that apartment by myself, I realized that I didn't really have much of a life at all. I still had a job, but I didn't have any hobbies. I didn't have any interests. I didn't have really anything outside of that family. And the family had been removed. And there I was sitting in this empty apartment trying to figure out what the heck I was supposed to be doing, you know? And the only thing that ever made me feel okay was to drink again. And I was afraid of what was going to happen all alone, you know, if I started drinking again. And I had a couple of bad episodes that I won't go into, but I mean, it was like, I couldn't remember how I got back home and I couldn't find my credit card and I smelled like really cheap perfume and I didn't remember anything and it scared the hell out of me. You know, it really did. So that was around this time of year. And I just have to say congratulations to all the people that are celebrating tonight and that took cakes. And especially if you're new, the first meeting of AA that I went to, you know, when she was going to Al-Anon, I thought maybe if I go to AA, I'll get her back. You know, I didn't really think I had a problem with drinking really, but the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, I went to an AA meeting and then the day after Thanksgiving, I went to an AA meeting and what I found there were people who were willing to listen to me and made me feel welcome. And I wasn't sure, I got a copy of that book, which I put under my bed, you know, as the network goes, and didn't really open it or read it or anything. And I was surrounded by people who were loved me enough to let me get through the holidays and pretend like nothing was wrong. You know, somebody would call that enabling, but you know, they were kind of like, let's just get through the holidays. And I said, yeah, let's just get through the holidays. I didn't live there anymore, you know, and whenever I showed up at my in-laws, they gave me that kind of look like I wasn't really even there. But when January came around, the locks were changed and the numbers were changed and nobody answered the phone. And that was the end of that. And I kind of hit the wall. I couldn't believe it. She really did it, you know, and there I was. And I started going to counseling to figure out what the heck my problem was because I knew emotionally I was a mess. And the counselor and I agreed that I would be better if I didn't drink. And so I agreed that I wasn't going to do that. And what I remember is she called me on a Sunday night and said, yeah, that group therapy we're going to do, that's not going to happen because not enough people signed up. Well, that was all I could afford. I couldn't afford one-on-one stuff anymore. And I said, well, thanks for letting me know. She goes, by the way, how's that not drinking thing going? And I said, great. And I hung up and I was on my second beer and I started crying. I thought, I'm paying somebody so I can lie to them. This is so stupid. And that was my last drink. You know, my last drink was two beers. And out of desperation, the next day, on a Monday, I went to the Shore Acres Gratitude Group in St. Petersburg, Florida. And I remember pulling up to the church and seeing all these cars. And I thought, oh, I'm going to have to ask these people at church where the AA meeting is. And it was the AA meeting, of course. And so I walked in and it was a book study. And I didn't have a 12 and 12, but the guy that I sat next to did, and he shared his book with me. And that was the kindest thing that anybody had done for me for quite a while. And that was February 6, 1990. And, you know, thanks to you people and the grace of God, this program, I haven't had to take a drink since then. And, you know, sometimes I think that everything I needed to know to stay sober, I really found out in my first year of sobriety. For folks that are new, I'll just tell you what they said to me, which is, you know, the 90 days and 90 days, you have to change your routines. It has to become, sobriety has to become more real than drinking and partying was. And so almost more real than anything else you're doing. At least for me, it was easy because I didn't have much of a life. Once I got home from work, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I sat on my hands for an hour and then I went to a meeting, you know, and then I went to the meeting after the meeting and then I came home and went to bed. I did that every day. Weekends were a little harder because there was a lot more time available, but I got some phone numbers and I started calling some people, and, you know, people do stuff and they'll invite you along with it. I couldn't believe they wanted me to be a part of that, but, you know, they did. But I was told that the first 12 months were a gift, you know, in my first full year after that was over, anything could happen. So they said, try to do one step a month, you know, because when you get to your 1 year anniversary, things may pick up a little bit. And I know that was certainly true for me. When I was 90 days sober, my dad passed away pretty suddenly in St. Louis, and that was unexpected. I did get to go to the funeral. I didn't, when he was in the hospital, I was like, I only could afford one plane trip. And so I could either go before or after, and I waited and went after. And I didn't have a sponsor yet. The next month, my wife announced to me that she was having an affair with somebody. She'd already found a replacement. So that wasn't going to come back. And then in June, you know, it was Father's Day. And I didn't have kids, but I had two stepsons and I'd been their dad for 7 years. And I called my sponsor and I said, you watch, I'm not going to get any Father's Day cards this year. And well, of course not. I didn't deserve any, but, you know, I thought I had expectations. And he said, well, let's just see what happens. And so that Saturday before Father's Day, I ran down to the mailbox and, you know, it was empty. And so I called her and told her how selfish she was for about an hour. And it didn't help at all. And after that fight that went on for an hour, I called my sponsor. And, you know, he said something I'll never forget. He said, I got two questions for you, Michael. First one is, why do you always call me second? Rhetorical question. He says, you know, that well's been dry for a while, but you keep going back there. And he said, I know it's Father's Day and you're missing your dad and you're missing your kids. But did it ever occur to you that you could have gone down to an Alano club and found somebody there who maybe didn't have his dad or didn't have his kids, or maybe didn't have anything to eat yet today? And you could have said, hey, you want to go get a burger? How do you think that might have made you feel? And I said, well, probably better, you know, and I hadn't thought of that. And he said, well, this is really important. He said, so let's remember this. The next time you feel bad, instead of finding somebody that has what you need and trying to take it away from them, you can find somebody that needs what you have and give it away freely to them. And you will immediately feel better and you will not need anybody else's permission to do it. And I said, that sounds great. So, well, that's good because that's 180 degrees away from you've been doing it all your life so far. So this is going to be really new behavior for you. So that was Father's Day. You know, the divorce became final in July. I had already worked, I think, the first three steps. I realized that I was really powerless over my drinking because I'd never been able to stop for any significant length of time without starting up again. And I knew my life was unmanageable. I felt like here I am starting all over at 37, and I don't really have the slightest clue what's the matter with me. And what I was told is that these principles that we try to practice, that there's a principle for each step. The spiritual principle behind step one is honesty. And so when I finally started talking to you guys, after I heard you be honest with me, I was willing to be honest with you. And maybe the problem wasn't my marriage. Maybe the problem was me. And, you know, that I was selfish and self-centered. And the only thing that made me feel better was getting loaded. And I didn't know how to be generous, and I didn't know how to be sharing, and I didn't know how to go up and say, hey, do you want to go get a burger? And, you know, you were able to do that for me. I was not able to do that for you yet. And that was honest. And step two, you know, I'd always had a spiritual background, but I said, you know, the first part was being restored to sanity. I had to really appreciate that I was pretty crazy, you know, that what I had done was making no sense at all. And that took a little longer, you know, but when I started talking to other alcoholics and telling you what I've just told you, it was clear that was really crazy. And not only doing the same thing, expecting different results, you know, but trying to get through life, taking, you know, getting satisfaction out of at your expense, you know, that the only way I knew how to feel better was to make you feel worse. And you know what? That doesn't work. And I began to realize that, how crazy that was. You know, so I really wanted to believe there's a power greater than me that could fix that. I didn't really know how to do it. It went away when I drank, but I couldn't drink anymore because it didn't solve my problems. And what you shared with me as I started going to those meetings is that the problem was resolved for you. And I thought, if it worked for you, maybe it will work for me. And that's when I got hope. And that was the spiritual principle behind step two, was hope. And you know, what's funny about those first two things is that this is not something I figured out with my wonderful mind. I didn't hear this till a couple of years ago, but I had the experience of what it felt like to be honest. And I had the experience of what it felt like to have hope. And, you know, finally, when I started doing the things that you suggested, turning my will and life over to the care of a power greater than me, I started getting really different results. My life started to change. And that's how I got faith. And I got the experience of faith because I was getting results. Something was happening and it was different, you know. And I didn't do the four step right away. I have to say, I didn't jump into that. I had a lot going on. As I said to my sponsor, I'm working, you know, and I've got some pretty important responsibilities. And he was so great because I have to tell you know, I've tried to be a sponsor the way he was a sponsor to me, which is to say, you know, honestly, what got me sober might get you drunk. I don't know what's best for you. I really don't. I can only share my experience with you. And if it sounds like if something that might work, you might want to try it instead of your way. And that's about where he would leave it. And so when I said, well, I feel like I should be doing a fourth step. And he said, well, then let's do a fourth step. And I said, I'm not sure I'm ready. He says, well, then let's not do that. I said, but everybody's telling me it's time to do the fourth step. And he said, well, then let's do the fourth step. But I'm really busy at work. Well, then let's not do it. I said, what are you telling me? You know, should I do it or not do it? And he goes, yeah. Should do it or not do it, but don't keep talking about it and worrying about it, because that doesn't do any good. And, you know, as it happened, well, two things happened really. First, one is I met this girl at a meeting who was about 10 years younger than me, and we got to be good friends. She was a student in the program. She was taking notes, and I was impressed by that. I thought that was really, you know, a good idea. And I was over at her house watching movies one night, and I said, it's pretty late, you know, and she said, you know, I know what you're trying to do here. This is not going to happen. There's the door. And I said, why not? We get along so well, you know, and I did all my stuff. And I said, just give me a reason. You know, you're a smart woman. I'm a smart man. Why isn't it going to happen? And she finally blurted out. She said, because you haven't done your fifth step yet. She was right about that. She had done her fifth step. I hadn't done it. She was about a year more sober than me. And I said, well, how will that matter? And she said, it just will matter. And I said, no, please. I really want to understand. And see, I'll never forget what she said. She said, because once you do your fifth step, I will be the answer to a problem you will no longer have. That's why I don't want you to stay over here. And you see, I never forgot that because as it happened, I convinced her to let me stay overnight anyway. She gave in, and for about 3 months there, we were an item. And then I finally did do my fifth step. And then a week or two after that, I realized, what the hell am I doing in this relationship? This is crazy. And I knew what was going to happen next. And I had to have that honest conversation because she was in the program too. And I said, you know, that thing you said that night, you were right. And she started crying and I felt pretty bad and I started crying too. But, you know, there's a real important idea behind that. You know, there's a lot of things that once we do the work in the program, these things are the outside solutions. They're not really the solutions. And I think they are. I think this will fix me. A little more money, promotion, car, the right relationship, and I'll be great. But, you know, those things are the answer to a problem I don't have if I just work the steps. And having sponsored a lot of guys in since I've been sober, you know, we get in here and we really want to fix all the outside stuff. Now that I'm sober, you know, let's get rid of the wreckage of the outside. And my sponsor used to say, you know, everything that's alive grows from the inside out, not from the outside in. And so you can fix all the outside stuff, but if your inside is still chaotic, eventually the outside is going to be chaotic too. So why not do, you know, what every other living thing does? Let's work on the inside stuff first. And once you get calm and peaceful, eventually all the outside stuff will match that also. And you know what? I found that to be true, you know, but like out in the rest of the world, we always focus on the outside stuff. And that's what I always want to go to. And if I fix the outside stuff, then I'll finally be ready to get spiritual. And that's not how it works. So the good news is I stayed friends with that woman, and I'm actually the godfather of her daughter, who's probably 26, 27 years old now, and she lives in Cleveland. We stay in touch because in the program, you know, there are ground rules for engagement and how to deal with each other, and we've been able to do that. And, you know, I've been able to make amends as best I can, you know, but meanwhile, I got to learn a very important lesson. And so the other thing that happened is that the job that I had went away. And when I called my sponsor and I said, yeah, they're closing the business. I'm out of work. And he goes, well, that obstacle has been removed. And I was really scared because for the first time, I didn't have anybody else bringing any money in. And so I said, can we start working on that four step now? And he said, well, yeah, absolutely. And I remember going to a meeting during the daytime because now I could pick up two meetings because I wasn't working. And I went to a noon meeting there in Pinellas Park in St. Petersburg. And I said, you know, this topic was fear. And I said, I'm really afraid right now because I'm out of work and I don't know when I'm going to get work. And so there was a guy there and he said, are you praying? And I said, well, I thought about it. And he said, only alcoholics get confused between thinking about stuff and actually doing it. Does thinking about eating make you any less hungry than actually eating? And I said, no. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. And this guy's name was Fireman Norm. And Fireman Norm was from Boston. He retired fireman. And he said that he was always willing when he was new. They told him that he needed to pray because he's in a very dangerous position. And sooner or later, the fear was going to cause him to drink again. And he was willing to say his prayers when he was at home. But, you know, the way the firemen work, it's kind of 3 days on and 2 days off. And so when he was at the firehouse sleeping there, he was too embarrassed to hit his knees and pray. He was afraid they were going to make fun of him. And his sponsor said, let me tell you what. He said, eventually, he says, either learn to hit your knees or you're going to be back hitting the bottle. That's your choice. And then he said, sure enough, there was a 3-alarm fire one night and a couple of close calls. They almost lost some people. And when he came back to the firehouse, they were shaking. And he was shaking. And he realized he was going to have to hit his knees next to his bunk before he went to bed, or he wasn't going to be able to sleep, and he wasn't going to be okay. And he determined, he said, to get down there and stay down there until it got quiet. And so he was next to his bunk until he couldn't hear anything anymore, and he figured everybody's already in bed and what have you. And so he got up, determined to hit anybody that laughed, and he said all the other firemen were next to their bunks praying also. And he said, that's when I realized that my sobriety was not mine. That just by staying sober, I could be an example to other people of what was possible. And they kind of looked at me and said, so what's your problem? What's your problem? Why can't you pray? So I started saying the prayer that I opened with. That became my prayer for the first, you know, year of my sobriety. Help me be a clear, transparent channel of your life, your love, your wisdom, and your power. And I really didn't know who I was praying to or what I was praying about, but that seemed to help. It seemed to help. It was something I was told to do, so I did it. I got invited to be a speaker when I was about 10 months sober, and I hadn't done my fifth step with my sponsor yet. We did finish my fourth step, but not my fifth step. And I told him I was going to be a speaker at a meeting like this. And he said, well, before you tell them, why don't you tell me? And so on Saturday, I went over to his house and we spent 3 or 4 hours going through my fifth step. And then I went home like they say to do, and for a couple hours laid on my bed and just was quiet, like the book says. And I don't know what I expected, but I think, you know, I did a lot of drugs in my time. So I thought euphoria was the next indicative thing that was going to happen. And didn't have that, you know, just got kind of quiet. And then I went to a meeting just like this and got up and was speaking. And what was so interesting was I was a 30-minute speaker when it was over and everybody came up and said, thank you. And, you know, shake hands like we do. I realized that a wall between me and you had been removed and I didn't even know it was there till it was gone. You know, and it was explained to me that that was the wall that I built around my ego to keep you out so you can't see my secrets. Because if you know who I really am, you'll hate me. Because I know I'm not good enough. And, you know, I can't stop drinking on my own. There's a power greater than me that can do for me what it can do through me if I'm willing to have it. And when the walls came down, suddenly that became available by being honest, by doing the housekeeping. You know, step 6 and 7 is a continuous thing for me. We did kind of the initial stuff based on what my fifth step said. There were some really clear character defects that I had. And I'll tell you, in case it helps you, I don't like to call them character defects. When I work with a sponsee, I say defense mechanisms, because the guy said, you know, they're character defects. They're defective. Why wouldn't we want them removed? And he said, well, if you change it from character defects to defense mechanism, then you'll know why you don't want it removed. Because if you don't have any defense mechanism, that means you're going through life defenseless. And who the hell wants to do that, right? Unless we've got a power greater than us that's in charge of things that can help protect us and know, you know, that nothing that you do or say can hurt me. I can just hurt myself. So it turns out I have a lot of defense mechanisms. And slowly but surely, well, I was going to try really hard to be a better guy. I don't know about you. That didn't work too well. Because under stress, I go back into these same behaviors, and this is what I do. And my sponsor explained, you know, did it ever help to stop drinking, to say you're going to try really hard? And I said, no. And he goes, has it stopped you from misbehaving and from acting the way you used to act? And I said, no, it isn't working so good. He said, yeah, we have to get sick and tired of being sick and tired with our behavior, too. And then we can ask our higher power to remove it, and it will be removed, as long as there's no payoff in it for you anymore. And so I've tried to remember that and do that when I can. You know, it helps to notice what it is so that I can ask to have it removed. 8 and 9 was interesting. You know, making amends is never fun. I didn't have a lot of amends to make. I'll just tell you one interesting story. When I was 5 years sober, my sponsor moved away and he grew up in St. Petersburg, Florida. So if you grew up in St. Pete, you can't retire there. You have to move someplace else. It's like the law. So he moved to North Carolina and left me high and dry. And I thought, you know, if he can leave Florida, why can't I leave Florida? You know, where else would I love to go? And my little brother said, there's that nonprofit group in San Diego that you've always been excited about. You know, why don't you go check that out? And, you know, I was single and I had some money and I didn't like my job too much. And I'd been sober for about 5 years. And, you know, I was starting to get that feeling where you plateau and you say, I got sober for this. You know, the chaos is gone, but my life doesn't really feel very good yet. And my sponsor said, there's two questions every man needs to answer, Michael. The first one is, where are you going? And the second one is, who's going with you? And he says, you always have to answer them in that order or you get really confused. And I realized I'd always look, I don't know how to answer number one. I don't know where I'm going, but I'll find somebody to go with me and ask if they know where they're going, and I'll just follow them around for a while. And that really hadn't worked. And so this was new advice to try that. And yeah, my brother, it was right. There's a group here in San Diego, a nonprofit that I always wanted to work with. But, you know, when he suggested that, he works for American Airlines. He has for 40 years, unlike me, with a lot of different jobs. And he said, well, why don't you go out to San Diego and check it out? I said, I've never been to San Diego in my life. And he said, we sell tickets at the airport. Anybody can buy one and go. And I thought, you know, so I actually did. Came out here and checked it out and had no idea. I don't know why I thought, you know, San Diego was a lot like Old Town, like sort of Mexican and from haciendas. And turned out I got a job here 6 months later, you know, and I moved here when I was 5 years sober, just in time to celebrate my birthday, and went to work for a really great company. And I'd been in kind of a crappy relationship, surprise, surprise, when I left Florida. And I got a new sponsor. Dave Moore was my sponsor for 20 years. And God bless him. He passed away 3 years ago this month. And, you know, he taught me a lot of things that I needed to learn about making amends and doing, taking, you know, keeping track of my character defects. And after I've been sober for, I've been out here, he says, how come you're not dating? And I said, I'm taking the year off, Dave. And I really wanted to get with men's group and spend some time with men and other men. And so the first year I did that. And he said, well, it's been a year, you know, time to get back on the horse. I said, you know what? I'm pretty happy. You know, I got a group of guys that I'm with and life's working out okay. And he said, what are you afraid of? I said, I'm afraid of, what am I afraid of? I'm afraid of being rejected. Afraid of, he says, it's just dating. Anybody can do that. I said, honestly, Dave, I don't date. I take hostages. And, you know, the first ones that say, okay, that usually turns into trouble. And I just going to mention this in case this is you're ever in this situation. He said, well, so what do you do? I said, well, I ask somebody if they want to go out, and they say yes. I say, where do you want to go? He goes, no, that's not right. That's not how you do it. I said, well, how do you do it then? And he said, what do you like to do? Baseball, Padres game, tickets to La Jolla Theater, something, whatever. He says, you buy two tickets, and then you say, hey, I got tickets for Saturday night to see somebody you'd like to do. Would you like to go with me? And if they say no, you say, then you ask somebody else. And eventually somebody will say yes. And you go and you say, thank you very much. That was very nice. Don't get her number. Don't pick up the china. Don't do any of that stuff. You're doing research now. Find something else you want to do. Ask somebody else. And just do that for about 3 or 4 months. And he says, you don't know really what you even like. You're just doing research. It sounded crazy, like a lot of other things these sponsors tell you, you know, but I did it anyway because I really thought it would be a good idea to follow his advice. And so I asked out a whole bunch of people for, you know, 4 or 5 months. And even though I really didn't want to be doing that, it didn't feel right. And there were some really nice people and there were some that were not so nice. And the ones that were really nice, I really wanted to get to know them again. And I said, no, it's not what I was told to do. You know, one day. You're just going on one date. And so I did that. And then after about 6 months, it was about Memorial Day, I think I went to a party and met this woman who was really interesting and we had a lot in common. And so I got her phone number and asked her out and we went out and then I broke the rule and asked her out again. And by the third time, she said, do you have to leave so quickly? And I said, yeah, I'm kind of doing this research project with my sponsor. I'm trying not to get involved. And she said, well, there's the door, you know, see ya. And I said, let me make a phone call. And next Tuesday, the day after tomorrow, we will be married 24 years. And that's, I consider a miracle. Yeah, because that's not the way my life was before I got here. You know, that was the advice of a sponsor. And that's what Dave Moore did for me, you know, because nobody else would have given me that advice. And I don't know if I would have followed it. But there's a lot of ways to make amends. You know, I wanted to get back in touch with my my stepsons, and I was told to leave them alone. Dave said, "Do you see any? How old would they be?" It's well, like 35 and 40 probably by now. And he goes, "Do you see any guys in the program that are 35 and 40? Help those guys. You know, pay it forward." And so I've made a point of sponsoring younger guys in AA because I was not a good dad, and I was not a good stepdad, and I try to be different, you know, and pay that back. And that's how I make living amends to those guys. Really quickly, you know, the thing that impresses me the most about AA is that, you know, if we keep doing this program and you stay engaged, and which I've tried to just to have sponsees, I try to stay engaged, and things keep coming up, you know. And about 3 or 4 years ago, I realized that I'd suffered an awful lot of losses in my life, and I never really did anything about them. And it was a guy, Steve O, who handed a book to me called The Grief Recovery Handbook. And he said, "Have you ever looked at this?" And I said, "No." And he said, "You know, the steps are great for resentments and fears. They don't necessarily deal with our loss. If you're an alcoholic like I am, you've lost a lot of stuff. And we're told to just don't drink and wrap up and keep moving." And I did that. And then it was time to deal with that. And so there actually is a process, a little bit like doing a fourth and fifth step, where I got to look at all the things that I'd lost. And I wrote letters to those people who aren't here anymore. And what do you say to those people that needs to be said? And you say it to a sponsor or a third party, you know. And I had to forgive them for a lot of stuff. And I had to apologize for a lot of stuff. And I had to notice some things that were really important. And that work was powerful. I wrote about 8 letters, and every one of those letters I bawled like a baby when I was reading. And so it's called The Grief Recovery Handbook, and I recommend it at some point if that becomes a thing you want to do. There are people, it's written by 2 people who are sober, and so they know what this is all about. It's a different kind of an inventory. And then I'll say, you know, I was sponsoring a guy that I met on a cruise ship 3 years ago. He lives in Arkansas, and I live here, of course. And we've been meeting on Zoom regularly for 3 years, and his wife left him in May. And, you know, he was pretty angry with her. And I said, "Well, while she's gone, why don't we work on you? And I'll share whatever I can." You know, there's a thing called codependence where we get too wrapped up in other people's behavior. And he said, "Okay, I'm willing to try that." And so I went and got the book and read it so I could help him. And then I realized, darn, you know, I still do a lot of this stuff. And so the goal of that book is to accept other people's reality without judgment or criticism, especially my nearest and dearest, accepting her reality without judgment and criticism. My wife retired last year, so we've had a lot more time together, and I noticed that I wasn't behaving the way a loving husband should. And so in the process of trying to help him, I wound up helping myself. And she had just retired after 12 years as a hospice chaplain, so it gives you some idea of the person that I'm married to. And she told me that same thing. You know, she spent a lot of years listening to other people's fifth step because their loved ones wouldn't have anything to do with them anymore. And there they were on their deathbed. And you know, I'll close with this. She said, "The thing about you guys in AA is you try to keep your street clean. And that's the most important thing you can do because we don't really know how much time we have, you know." And she said, "They're being on somebody's deathbed when they've always thought there was going to be time to say this stuff, and they're out of time, and nobody wants to hear it. And there's nothing worse than the psychic pain that you feel when you run out of time to make your amends and tell the truth and tell people how important they are." And so she's been the one who sits there and goes, "Well, what would you say to your daughter if she were here? Say it to me." And by proxy, you know, she's able to give people a lot of relief. And, you know, that's the kind of relationship that I'm grateful for in this program, because I've learned a lot about that higher power from working with, listening to her and to her stories. Steps 10, 11, and 12, you know, the beautiful part is it goes about as far as you want to go. I've been really grateful to be able to understand what a conscious contact feels like and looks like. But I didn't know that until I got here and you guys told me what was possible. You know, the problem for me is that my ego gets in the way. And you've taught me, give me the tools to remove that so that the sunlight and spirit comes through. And by sharing this stuff on a regular basis, you know, I become more available for that. So thank you for letting me be here tonight. And thank you for helping me stay sober. And especially at this time of the year, I hope you all have a wonderful Christmas. Thank you.